evening, everyone. The topic tonight is the Breslau Conference of 1846, which was, in my opinion, the most exciting of all the three rabbinical conferences, in that ideas were thrown around that were extremely radical and maverick, but also that would foreshadow the future of religious policy for the non-Orthodox denominations in the decades and century and a half to follow. So some things were mentioned in that year, in that conference, that you normally associate with the 20th century, not the 19th century, and maybe even conservative Judaism, not Reform Judaism. So what happened? First of all, the conference took place in Breslau. Where is Breslau? What country is it in?
Eastern Prussia.
So it's in Poland today, but back then it was East Prussia. And it was a German city. Today it's a Polish city. But the point is that you have a progressive rabbinical conference taking place at a point, at a geographic spot very far to the east. It's like a way of saying a thorn in the eye of the religious, because you normally associate progressive reforms with Western Europe or Central Europe, not Eastern Europe. And yet they're gathering, they're encroaching upon the territory of the traditionalists. Now, Breslau was the hometown of Abraham Geiger, at least at that point. He was the rabbi of the town, so he's going to dominate the proceedings. And the number of rabbis who gathered there was smaller than what had been the previous 2 years, in part because Zachariah Frankel, the positive historical leader, the middle-of-the-road party, he tried to have a competing congress, a conference of theologians that same year, which never materialized. It never happened. But because of objections by the more traditional rank of progressive rabbis, this gathering had fewer people in attendance. The main topic was going to be the Shabbos. It was already clear from the previous year that they had been dilly-dallying on the major issue of Sabbath observance. The inescapable reality was that the civil day of rest was not the same as the religious day of rest. The civil day of rest in Central Europe is Sunday, the Christian Sabbath, and the Jewish Sabbath is Saturday. And there's no getting around the fact that people who participate beyond the ethnic and close-knit economy, if you're participating in the major economy of the larger state, you're not going to function properly if you have to abstain from work on a work day every week. So,
in the 19th century, people worked every Saturday?
Some people did.
Like the school.
The schools were open. The places of business were open. There was no such thing as a two-day weekend.
Yeah, like
there was a six-day work week and a religious/secular Sabbath on Sunday. So this was a very difficult challenge for Jews who were integrating into mainstream society and were not just in the ethnic economy of the Jews. It's also a problem for kids going to school. If they don't go to a Jewish school, if they go to a publicly financed school or a Christian school, what are they going to do? How are they going to function if they're trying to adhere to the traditional rules of Shabbos observance and not writing and the like? So, what can be done about this? Well, Abraham Geiger opens up the proceedings by saying that the most important thing we could do at this gathering is have freedom of conscience and freedom of expression. In other words, there are ideas that may be floated that are contrary to the tradition in the extreme, but you might think that they're a good idea. And we don't want you to hold back from saying something because you feel you'll get into trouble if you say it. Say whatever's on your mind. Doesn't mean we're going to pass the most extreme measures, but be free to speak your mind. One fellow, Gotthold Salomon, who was the preacher in the Hamburg Temple, and was an older man at that point. He was already in his 60s, was considerably older than most of the other rabbis in the room. He said, there is no solution to this problem of the Sabbath. And since there is no solution, we shouldn't bring it up. In other words, don't engage in conversation on a topic where whatever we have to say will either not solve the problem or, worse, be destructive towards Judaism. Just let the problem exist in the real world, and whatever solutions people come up with on their own will be their solutions. We, the clergy, can offer nothing constructive.
Were those his words, that he referred to the Sabbath as a problem?
He referred to the social problem of non-observance of the Sabbath. He loved the Shabbos. This is Gotthold Salomon. He didn't want to talk about it. Now, that's the Frum position, by the way, because we're going to get to the much worse position. Well, the committee that was appointed by the previous year's conference to discuss and to come up with proposals for the Sabbath regulations, they came up with the following ideas, most of which were adopted by this conference. Let's go through them. First of all, in general, Shabbat observance is no longer to be defined by the Talmudic and Shulchan Aruch style of definition. So the 39 melachot, lametet avot melachot, 39 primary categories of labor, and the several hundred toladot, subsidiary categories of labor, we no longer will concern ourselves with those things. But rather, what is a violation of the work clauses of the Bible? Work, and maybe even exertion. Basically, professional activity, economic activity.
Wasn't that what they were arguing in the first place?
Well, we're going to see whether or not there are going to be exceptions even to this. But what they're trying to get across is, don't worry about the minutiae of melachot and toladot and siagim, rabbinic enactments and safeguards. That has been done away with. We'll have new definitions of what melacha, what work is, and what should be considered verboten on the Jewish day of rest. Okay, what about work? One's livelihood, one's profession, one's business. What can you do, what can't you do? So they suggested that in exigent circumstances, what we might say in halacha is le'et tzorech, in an hour of need, you can have a Gentile operate your business on the Sabbath, but you shouldn't be there. But in really exigent circumstances, what we might say is shas hadchak gadol, the great emergency situation, even the Jew can go and operate his business, but he should run back home as soon as possible and observe the rest of the Sabbath in his home in an appropriate fashion. So these are the exceptions that are carved out into the Reform Sabbath law. What else? For the saving of life, all is permitted. Now, is that consistent with traditional halacha? Okay, all right, I'm glad you brought it up. So the traditional halacha would argue that under biblical law, you are permitted to violate the Sabbath to save a Jew, but that under biblical law, you are not permitted to violate the Sabbath to save a Gentile, yet because of consideration of anti-Judaic animus, Mishum Eiva, will save anyone, even the worst Cretans in the world, will save them on Shabbos, even with violation of biblical melachot. But it's only because of the sociological reality that we are a beleaguered people surrounded by hostile enemies who are stronger than us, and we'll get into trouble if we don't save them. So Mishum Eiva will save anybody.
What's the Hatzolah guy sees a terrible accident.
You save people. All right, but what do the reformers say? There's no distinction between Jew and Gentile. Not in reality, and not in theory. So the change is, practically speaking, not a change at all. But in the theory, it's a change. Okay, what else? For religious purposes, all prohibited labors become permitted. Meaning, in the conduct of the divine service, all is fair game. Give me two very important ways in which that would manifest itself.
Organ
and driving to shul. Okay, so the organ, we already saw in the Hamburg Temple controversy of 1819. Driving to shul becomes a 1950 issue in the conservative movement with the teshuvah, the responsum written by Rabbis Friedman, Adler, and I forget the third one, who said that for attending synagogue services, you're allowed to drive to the synagogue, but only for attending synagogue services, not for recreational purposes can you drive anywhere. Which was, in its moment, a very controversial decision, although probably very necessary from the conservative point of view. Here you have 1846, 104 years earlier, that travel for the sake of attending religious services is okay.
Wait, so yeah. These people were not religious. They didn't. What was this whole thing? It was ridiculous.
These are rabbis of communities. And these communities may have very pious members. And these rabbis themselves might be regarded as somewhat traditional Jews who, despite their intellectual inclination towards the Reformation of Judaism, in practice, are ruling over congregations that adhere to traditional religious life.
Weren't they all Reformed congregations?
Not necessarily. They were. Some of them were ideologically Reformed, like the Berlin Reformed Synagogue, the Hamburg Temple, and some other places. But most of them were community rabbis, where they personally were progressive in their religious orientation, but the community as a whole had a mixed bag. Okay.
He had a bus going to the conservative temple.
Uh-huh.
Not one.
The Shah bus.
The Shah bus.
Yeah.
Many out of town, modern, very modern Orthodox synagogues had the parking lot open.
Parking lot open, yeah, sure, it's true, it's true. Okay.
When we were in San Francisco, there was a Jew Israel there, uh-huh. and because of the congregation, that was not frowned upon at all.
In many, many places, the parking lot is open. Now, a block, two blocks away is even better. Okay. So, in any event, what else is permitted? What else is permitted? So, two very, very, very important things were permitted by these rabbis at the Breslau Conference. One, a Jewish soldier in the military can disregard all Sabbath restrictions and do his duty as a soldier. What relevance is that?
So what?
Well, the point is not just in moments of combat, but generally speaking, a soldier can disregard the Sabbath. Why do the Reform rabbis take this position? So the Machne Yisrael says that a Jew who's a soldier in the Tsar's army, or for that matter any other army, has to at least make the attempt of Shmira Shabbos, but that for the sake of not getting into trouble, not getting court-martialed, or losing your life in a combat situation, of course you do whatever makes sense. Now, why do the Reform rabbis make a big deal about the military you serve, you violate Shabbos? Yeah.
Because the people want to go to the army, so they be integrated in society.
Okay. So in the 1780s, there was a big machlokus. We learned about this last year. Between Moses Mendelssohn and Johann David Michaelis, who was a Christian pastor, who was a Christian intellectual. And Michaelis argued against the emancipation of the Jews on the grounds that the most important civic responsibility that your average person has is not public office holding, but rather conscription into the military. All right, 1,000 to 1,000 people that get conscription to the military, they'll fight in wars. Well, the Jew can't be a loyal soldier or an effective soldier because dietary laws and Sabbath rest laws will prevent them from fulfilling their responsibilities. What did Mendelssohn respond? That if you give the Jews the chance to serve in the military, that the individual Jew will make his own accommodations to military life, and that religious scruples will not interfere with full participation. Now, Mendelssohn, not being a rabbi or a halachist, was not there to offer the specific nature of those accommodations and how it might play itself out in the real world. Nor was he really looking forward to Jews serving in armies in large numbers because he was not exactly a warmonger. He's just saying that part of emancipation includes the possibility of conscription, and if it happens, don't worry, the Jews will figure it out. And you know what? He was right. The Jews do figure it out. In every Western army since the Enlightenment, Jews have fought and done their duty and acquit themselves with honor. Okay, even including in armies where they weren't so happy to be there, like the Tsar's army.
In the 19th century, there was universal conscription.
No, no.
So these were all volunteers.
No, there was conscription in wartime.
No, no.
In certain Central European states, there was conscription in wartime. In others, there was universal conscription, like in Russia. Well, universal of the not universal, but of the Jews, there was coerced conscription of some, not all, Cantonists. And then in World War I, some states had voluntary service; others had forced conscription. But whether it was coerced or it was voluntary, the point is, could a Jew do it and still be a Jew? The answer is, for the Reformers, yes. Okay. The next point is, what if you're a holder of public office? You're either elected or appointed. You know, you're the water commissioner in Mannheim, or you're the police commissioner in Salzburg, who knows where. And you have responsibilities to carry out on the Sabbath or a holiday. Can you do it? The answer, yes. That's what the Reform rabbis would say. Why do they say this? Because if emancipation is going to be a reality, it's not just that we're like second-class citizens who at best can serve in the military. No, no, we're going to be appointed to the highest level of governmental positions. But if we're going to be appointed or be elected, we have to be able to carry it out to the best of our ability and not say, well, you know, Shabbos Hayom, Pesach Hayom is the old Talmudism. Today's the Sabbath, today's Pesach, I can't do anything. But they do have the caveat that if you're a public official and you do race to your job to carry out some function, when you come home in the privacy of your own home, you should do your best to consecrate the day as a Jewish Sabbath. Okay, yeah.
So I have to say, Ad Hayom Hazeh, yeah. Jared Kushner, in challenging situations,
yeah.
Finds rabbinical
dispensation.
Yeah. So I didn't have that with the store. Shabbos, every dollar, they're allowed to open the store, all the money is paid for bills or anything else.
Nobody beats the Wiz.
No person. Yes. Not many yeshivas on Shabbos.
Alright, well, yeah.
Could you comment on the constituency of the conference in terms of who is representing the Orthodox point of view?
Nobody. The nominally traditional point of view was represented by a small faction at this conference, but even the middle of the road party, which is the forerunner to conservative Judaism, they left in a huff and a puff the previous year. So there's no one representing a very rigorously halachic point of view here at this gathering. Nobody.
Why did it have such an enforceable victim?
It didn't. And we're going to see that a lot of the things that are said here are not put into practice, even in the Reform movement, for another 50, 100 years. Okay. So the big question that comes up in this discussion, what is the main purpose of Shabbos? If I were to ask you, what is the main purpose of Sabbath observance, what is it?
I mean, is it Orthodox or is it...
Forget Orthodox, forget not Orthodox. Shabbos, what is the purpose of Shabbos? Yeah. Okay, I hear rest, I hear to testify that there's a God who created the world. What else?
And the main thing that establishes a person as a Jew.
So nobody says that. People say that about Bris. But about Shabbos, we don't... Well, let's put it this way. If you're a non-Sabbath observer, then it, Talmudically speaking, it's like Dino Ka'akum, you have the status of a Gentile. However, by the 19th century, nobody was really adhering to that Talmudic stricture.
They said that if you...
Yeah.
It's worse for the laws of Shabbos than anything else.
Well, it's a capital crime according to the Bible. There are other capital crimes. So it's very, very important, but it's not the defining element of Jewish status. Not by the 19th century, yeah.
Jews kept Shabbos, and Shabbos kept the Jews.
That's right. That's an Achara Amism. So that's a good 50 years later, but he was on target. He was very much on target, and we're going to see how any attempt to tinker with the Shabbos is going to lead to the demise of Judaism. So, what are the two theories about the purpose of Shabbos? One is it's a day of rest. Man needs a day off. Shavat vayi nafash. You got to catch your breath. You can't work 7 days a week. You'll be destroyed physically if you do that. So It's a necessary institution in the life of human beings. You have to take a day off. And it has religious connotation. But vayinafash, the day off, abstaining from work. The other theory is consecration. Okay? Alkei meirach at yom ha-shvi. Okay, what does it say? Vayikadesheu. And God sanctified it. Lekadesho. Oneg. Karat le-shabbat oneg. So there is an element of consecration. It's not just abstaining from work, the absence of productive things, but rather it's the holiness of the day and the ability of the day to sanctify the Jew, to make the Jew a better person, a better human being, a better Jew. All right? Well,
that's according to the Talmud.
Okay, you're right. So as Samuel Holtheim, the radical, acknowledged, biblically speaking, the main focus is the day off, the day of rest. Okay, lo tasa kol malacha. But Talmudically, and maybe in the latter books of the Bible, like in Isaiah, the focus is on the performative aspects of Shabbat, and the fact that it is a consecrated day that can lead to the spiritual elevation of the observer. Well, if you take the viewpoint of rest, or you take the viewpoint of consecration, It will matter in a big way about how you'll focus on the reformed Sabbath. If the focus is on rest, then you'll take a more demanding viewpoint of what is forbidden. Not just that work, like your occupation, your profession is off limits, but even anything that requires major league exertion should also be forbidden.
Right.
You should literally rest from anything that is a tremendous toil, whether it's remunerative or not. However, if you feel that consecration is the main thing, then we can sort of encourage rest and inactivity, because inactivity or the absence of mundane activity gives you time to go to religious services in the synagogue and do home-based rituals, but you could probably get away with going to work a little bit and also going to shul in the home-based rituals. So as long as you had your divine service in the Saturday morning in the house of worship, and you had your Borei Pri Hagafen and your Hamotzi Lechem Min Haaretz, your Zmiris and your benching, you were in the clear. So
that's why they made
the Hashkama Minyan. So you daven and then you go to work, right? It's true. It's true. So these, yeah. So for example, the Kiddush, Hadlakat Neirot, Lechem Mishnah, Havdalah, ceremonial aspects of Shabbos. Okay.
But wasn't the Christian day of rest Sunday also a day of rest?
Yes, actual rest.
Yeah, actual rest.
Yeah, sure. Okay, blue laws. There's things that are forbidden. You can't go. You can't open up a shop right, and do certain types of work.
Form is advocating being bigger goyim than the goyim.
I don't know. Okay. So,
but it seems to be. These two reasons go very well with the Reformed, because exertion, if you drive to shul, or if you drive to the mall or something, that's not work. That's not exertion. Uh-huh. If you go ahead and you do something performative, they said that. You go to work if you have to, but you go home and you do in your house what you got to do as far as Shabbos.
Granted. So what the goal was here, it was to make possible Sabbath observance for people who lived in a society which would not allow them, or not easily allow them, to have a full day off. So what can you do? A whole host of things that technically are forbidden according to Talmudic law, but as long as there is the flavor of a Jewish sacred day, you have now done your religious duty. Okay. So this was not good enough for some people. Some rabbis posited that there was that if you made the synagogue service more attractive with an edifying sermon, with a fancy choir singing nice melodies, and that it was a good kiddush after the services, if the performative aspects of communal Sabbath observance were better, were more enticing, maybe people would take time off from work or time off from their mundane activities. However, others figured there's no way even fancy and impressive religion is going to win out over the realities of secular life. Therefore, what must happen? So Samuel Holtheim, ever the most extreme radical of the Reform movement, says the only choice is to switch Shabbos to Sunday. Switch Shabbos to Sunday. And he denied that this was a concession to Christianity, but rather it's an attempt to save Judaism. Save Judaism. I have probably mentioned this in the past. One of the classic lines of Geiger, and for that matter Holdheim used it too, was Stira al manat livnot. What is Stira al manat livnot? Destruction for the sake of building. And Stira al manat livnot in halacha is what? It's considered binyan. It's considered construction, not destruction. So though at the superficially, at first glance, it looks like it's a destructive act, it's in fact a positive thing. You know, you destroy the old rundown house so you can build a mansion in its place. That's the... Huh?
Friday night Shabbos also. Okay, what do they do? What do they say? Friday night, go to work, then Sunday, start again.
Okay, so those who opposed this transition from Shabbos on Saturday to Shabbos on Sunday had a great degree of criticism for Holdheim, thinking this was a disaster. One said, you're turning this into Christianity. Another said, you're burying Judaism on Friday night only to have it resurrected on Sunday morning as another religion. That was the classic line of Leopold Stein, the rabbi of Frankfurt. Now, Holdheim understood that this was such a radical suggestion, there was no way it was going to pass. And so he did not even propose it as a resolution to be adopted by, to be voted on by the conference, but rather it was just a statement he was making for public consumption, for people to talk about, not to vote on. He knew full well he was in the fringe minority on this. The only one who agreed with him, there were two, Samuel Hirsch of Luxembourg agreed with him, and Mendel Hess agreed with him. But what did I tell you about Mendel Hess? That he was an anti-Semitic rabbi. He hated Judaism with a passion. And so he was happy to see any sacred institution of Judaism destroyed. You can do more damage to Judaism as a heretical rabbi than you can as a layman on the outside. Okay. So this was a big topic of conversation. Holdheim puts it forth. And people are hostile to it. People are in favor of it. What could be done? They were not going to vote on this. There was no way. It was too extreme. That doesn't mean that there were no individual congregations that wanted to adopt it. There were some, but there are gradations. The most extreme form is you have a synagogue in a town, and you have one service a week, and you hold that service on Sunday, and it's a Sabbath service. Your liturgy includes references to Shabbat, to Sabbath. That's the most extreme form. Terrible. A shanda. What's a less extreme form? You have one service a week, because your people won't come on Saturday since they're busy working. So you hold it on Sunday, which is the secular day off, but that service is a service of the Yom Chol. Okay, instead of saying Tikanta Shabbos Retzitur Kamunoteo Yismach Moshe Matnas Chalko, what do you say? Ata Chonein LeAdam Dat. You have a weekday Shmon Esrei. Now, why do it? Answer: people want to pray. They want to pray communally. They want to at least do it once a week, and they'll do it on the day that is most convenient for them. But if you're going to do it on that day, do what's Judaically appropriate for that day. Don't pretend as though it's Shabbos. So if the worst is making Shabbos on Sunday, the second worst is only having services on Sunday, but having it be a weekday service. What's the next worst? And
about to be Kriyas HaTorah.
Forget about Kriyas HaTorah. Don't worry about that.
What about Kiddush?
I don't know. Kiddush is a home-based ritual. We're talking about the synagogue here. So the next possibility, and several communities did this, was if you weren't having services every day, because the bottom line is you didn't have the clientele who was coming every day for Minyan, but you wanted to preserve the Saturday Sabbath, and you did, but you also wanted to have people come to services who were working Saturday, you'd make a Sunday service, but have a davening of the Yom Chol, a weekday service. In other words, shul is open 2 days a week, Shabbos and Sunday. And Sunday is not Shabbos, but it's available for the people who can only come that day. That's not so terrible. Okay. But how do you know what is the primary service? The answer is, when does the rabbi speak? Because the rabbi is not going to give two sermons, one on Saturday, one on Sunday. He's going to give one speech, and whenever he gives the speech, that's the sort of the imprimatur that this is the primary service of the week. So if he does it on Sunday, that is like a concession to Christendom. Yeah. There's nothing inherently wrong with it, but if you're making a choice of Saturday or Sunday, it's indicative of the sentiment.
Yeah, but if okay. Someone was coming on Saturday, what the hell?
Right. Okay. Okay. Now, some other things the Sabbath law were abolished. Anything that was a far-fetched aspect of the Sabbath law was declared inoperative. What is considered far-fetched? Well, it's in the eye of the beholder, to be honest. But specific things were eliminated. Eruvei Chatzerot, Eruvei Tuchumin. Now, what is Eruv Chatzerot and what is Eruv Tuchumin? Eruv Chatzerot is, you know, in common parlance, it's the wire around the town. But really, the Eruv Chatzerot is actually the supply of food that is deposited in relation to the wire around the town. It allows people to carry in the enclosed area. The Eruv Tuchumin allows you to walk beyond 2,000 cubits past the city boundaries. You can go another 2,000 cubits if you deposit a supply of food towards the edge of the Sabbath boundary. So they regarded Eruv Chatzerot and Eruv Tchumen as hereby abolished. Why? Because It's a legal fiction. And legal fictions are an embarrassment to modern Judaism. But moreover, for commercial purposes, they are inappropriate. And for non-commercial purposes, they're unnecessary. Meaning, if you're doing it, if you're carrying or walking beyond the boundary for a legitimate recreational or spiritual purpose, you don't need this eruv. And if you're doing it because you want to conduct some kind of business, then you shouldn't be doing the business in the first place. So therefore, either way you slice it, the eruv is of no consequence.
Did
abolished.
Anybody care?
So I'm sure that they were eruvei chatzerot in some of the towns where these rabbis functioned as the official clergymen. That doesn't mean that they were tearing the wire down the city just because the Breslau conference said you don't need it anymore. I would imagine that in some places, the traditionalists insisted upon maintaining it, and even if the rabbi said, I don't think it's important anymore, the pietists will hold on to it. That's in general what happened. Just because the rabbi of the town was moving in the direction of being practically a shegetz doesn't mean everybody in town was. Some people preserved their piety and broke away and formed Orthodox synagogues, including with it all the various communal rituals like Eruv. Okay, so that was the discussion of the Sabbath. When we talk about next week, the Berlin Reform Congregation, we'll see how they implemented Sunday Sabbath, at least for a little while. That was the most extreme of all the various houses of worship. What were some of the other things that were on the agenda? So, holidays were on the agenda. As was discussed in some of the earlier conferences, the second day of the Yom Tov is not especially well-liked. And there are people clamoring for its abolition.
Here too.
Well, there was an acknowledgement that this is not a universal sentiment. It depends upon the community. In some places, they like the extra day of Yom Tov. Other places, not. And the theory was that in those places where people work very, very hard, they're struggling, they like the extra day off. The extra day of Chag is to them really a Chag. That when you are a manual laborer, you toil out in the fields or in the shops, and you have an opportunity for 48 hours of off time on a religious basis, you're going to be in favor of it. I don't know, not everyone I'm sure would think that way, but some people would. So the conference decided that getting rid of the second day of Yom Tov is something that is an option available to the various congregations, but to be decided on a case-by-case basis, meaning each shul can do its own thing. Moreover, you don't have to be consistent. You can maintain, let's say, Simchas Torah, but do away with the second day of Shavuos. You can mix and match. It doesn't have to be a consistent one day of Yom Tov or 2 days of Yom Tov. Those things which you like, you can preserve. Those things which you don't like, you don't have to preserve. Which is basically liberal Judaism at its finest. There's picking and choosing without a coherent explanation. There could be a totally subjective rationale to it. Yeah.
Can that be considered divisive?
Yes.
Within the reform?
Yes, it could be very divisive, because if in fact people make different choices and you don't have a consistent policy, then you don't have a movement, you don't have a denomination. But bear in mind, I don't think there's an attempt at creating a so-called movement or a denomination. There's just an attempt at the reform of Judaism, and we're still dealing in a time period when the local kehillah is the be-all and end-all. You see, today in America we have the notion of the conservative movement, the reform movement, and there's a union of congregations, and then there's a union of rabbis, and there's a seminary that ordains people. It's a package that has well-defined parameters, and you want to have consistency within those parameters. But Europe in the mid-19th century was not that way. We're still dealing with there's the local Jewish kehillah. What do? And I don't care what they do two towns over. That's not us. We're right here. If we make a decision, it's our decision. It's fine. They made one distinction, however. Second day of Rosh Hashanah should not so easily be abolished. Now, they didn't say you have to observe it. They didn't say you have to observe it. But even if you're inclined to get rid of last day Pesach, last day Sukkot, last day Shavuos, think twice about getting rid of second day Rosh Hashanah. Why?
It's not
Sfeika de Yoma. But wait a second. It's still not biblical. And if we're moving in the direction of sort of biblical Judaism or getting away from Talmudic Judaism, why treat the second day of Rosh Hashanah with any greater reverence than the eighth day of Pesach?
But isn't it like one long day?
Yes, but by Talmudic rules, popular not because
acceptance.
The Torah says so.
Popular acceptance.
Okay, that's right. Popular acceptance. Popular acceptance means that in the eyes of the not-so-educated layman, the second day of Rosh Hashanah is a big deal, whereas the latter days of some of the other holidays are not a big deal. So therefore, let's be hesitant. Now,
Rosh Hashanah was paid off with Yom
Kippur. Yeah. Two days was one day. Yeah.
Besides the food and the chauffeur and all that, that's part of that package.
Now, if you were an extremist and you were a reform ideologue, what kind of problem would you have with this idea of reverence for the second day of Rosh Hashanah? That there's an inconsistency here. If we're going to take the knife and cut all that is superfluous, there's nothing special about the second day of Rosh Hashanah any more so than the latter days of the other holidays. They kept 2 days. Yes, yes, yes. So
it's the only chag we have that's on Rosh Hashanah.
That's true. Yeah, yeah. And right.
About Tisha B'Av.
That's why 2 days. Yeah. Okay. You're right. Okay. So what other holiday issues came up? Well.
Well, what if they had 3 days?
Don't ask them. I'm sure they didn't like that. Other holiday issue that came up was the observance of the shofar and the lulav on Shabbos. Insofar as those ceremonies were to be preserved, which, by the way, was far from a guarantee because those two ceremonies came under a lot of criticism over the years in the Reform movement, but if they were to be observed, the Sabbath would not be an impediment to observing those rituals. Why? Because Talmudically, what's the objection? Concerns about carrying. So since we're abolishing the laws of carrying and the considerations of Eruv, well, people like the ceremony, so do the ceremony. And if people don't like it, you were going to get rid of it anyway. Yeah. Okay. Now, what else was on the agenda? So now we get to the topic of women's equality. Women's equality. Well, the reformers spoke a good. They talked a good game about gender equality in Judaism, and especially David Einhorn. David Einhorn, who was an important rabbi even in Europe, but would go on to become one of the most important rabbis, reform rabbis in America, and an extreme radical on most issues, although not all issues. He was traditional in matters of intermarriage. He was very firmly in favor of the abolition of all gender distinctions. And he said that whatever gender distinctions exist in the Bible were only transitory in nature. What does that mean?
It doesn't apply today.
That they only were intended to apply in those years, in antiquity, in a bygone era when values were a little different. And it was patriarchal society, but not for the 19th century when we have seen the light and we know that men and women should be treated the same. Well, how does that play itself out? What areas of religious life? So the first one is mitzvot aseh shehazman grama, positive time-bound commandments. Now here we get to an oddity. Under Talmudic law, women are exempt from most, but not all, time-bound commandments. Why? Not for now. But most time-bound commandments. Those are typically rituals. Holiday rituals, daily rituals. The very sort of thing that the Reform movement was inclined to eliminate. So it's a bizarre situation where if the men are up here, the women are down here, so the women are elevated to now up here, and then everybody's brought back down to here. In other words, all the mitzvot that women have been exempt from for 2,000 years, they're now obligated just as equally as men, except no one's going to do them. So in a reform house of worship, is a woman going to wear tefillin? Well, no, because is a man going to wear tefillin? No! So it's a bit of a farce, but to the extent that certain ceremonial mitzvot were preserved, there'd be theoretical equality. In fact, many of these rabbis went on to continue serving their communities where the traditional mitzvot were observed, like tefillin, like talis, and along those lines. But were women wearing talis and tefillin? Absolutely not. Einhorn says this, the conference approves it, but it's really just a lot of hot air. It's talk, 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 but there was little implementation, very precious little implementation. So the first was Mitzvot Aseh Shehazman Grama. The second one, this is an interesting one. Mitzvot Ha'av Al Haben. The commandments of a father with respect to the child. There are five of them, according to the Brisa in the Gemara Kiddushin. One of the five. I wrote about it last week.
Swimming, education.
So first one is lamulo, to circumcise. Second, lifdoto, to redeem the firstborn child. Three, lalamdo Torah, to teach him Torah. Four, lahasio isha, to marry him off. And five, lalamdo manu, to teach him a trade. V'yesh omrim, and some say, af, lahashito b'mayim, to teach him how to swim. Okay, so these mitzvot are incumbent upon a father with respect to a child, but not a mother with respect to a child. So this has to do with the age-old question of who is a parent. And parenthood was seen as only a male concern, that there is no such thing as a mother. There only is only the father is a parent. The mother is like a uterus that carries a fetus until it's born into the world.
Early morning dominating.
What does it say? So no one doubts that, but in the extreme gender-biased form of not just traditional Judaism, but Western civilization as a whole, the parent was the father. It wasn't until the 1840s, right around the same time that we're talking about now, where there was the possibility of a woman getting custody of children in a divorce battle. Until that time, until the 19th century, it was assumed that if there is a divorce, the father gets custody because the father is the parent. There is no motherly parenthood. Oh, this came up when we discussed who is a Jew. The question of what makes you a Jew. Is it a Jewish mother or a Jewish father? One of the theories was that parenthood, the closer type of parenthood is that of the mother, therefore it should be based upon the maternal line. And we said, no, that's not true, because in all of Western civilization and in Judaism, only the father was regarded as something of a parent until modern times. So, what does any of this mean? It means that a mother has the achrayus, has the responsibility to take care of bris if the father is not around, or what if the father is a Gentile? All right, you have the possibility of mixed marriages. So is a mother who's raising the kid as a Jew going to be responsible to give the kid a cheder education, to give the kid pidyon haben, to marry the kid off? Mother is now responsible in all these things. Okay. Third point. Shelo asani isha. Gone. Now, that's gone. What else is gone? Shelo asani goy and shelo asani avid. Those three blessings are distasteful in the 19th century environment. What's the traditional explanation, like in the footnotes of the art school? What do they tell you to justify the saying of something as distasteful as the shelo asani goy, avid, or isha? What's the usual explanation? Okay, so the traditional explanation is that it's a hierarchy of obligation of mitzvot. That the goy has the least number, he has seven. The eved has more because he's a quasi-Jew. The woman has everything except for positive time bound. And the adult male Jew has all 613. Now the problem with that is, and I wrote about this a couple of years back, if you actually go to the Gemara and see who is the author of these brachot, it was Rabbi Meir. And what was Rabbi Meir's attitude towards women? What was his encounter with women? His wife had a problem with one of his students, an adulterous situation. And so Meir, across the board, if you read his halachic opinions and you combine it with the legendary stories about his personal life, he had not a very good view of women. Other Tanaim and Amoraim were more favorably inclined towards the piety and the character of women, not Rabbi Meir. So, with that in mind, how do I interpret the brachot? Literally, the adult male was happy that he was a male and not a woman. It's better to be a man than to be a woman. Simple as that. No fancy religious sophistication involved. And so, if that is how you want to read it, and how I think it was originally intended, then getting rid of it is a no-brainer. What's going to replace it? What's going to replace it? So for a woman, we already have Shasani Kirtzono. What about for a man?
Say the same thing.
Well, you'd have to change it to be grammatically correct for a man. But, no, so there are other options. Shasani Yisrael instead of Shasani Goy. Shelo asani goy. So turn it into a positive, affirmative attitude towards your identity, as opposed to saying, I am not that guy.
I think there is an Orthodox that
Yes, in the Hertz Siddur, in the authorized Anglo Siddur, I think it's like that. The Shasani Israel, Shasani Ben Chorin instead of Shaloh Asani Avid, and instead of Shaloh Asani Isha, Shasani Bitsalmo, that God created me in His image. Because who is created in the image of God? All of humanity. It's gender neutral. Bitsalmo Elohim applies to everybody. Okay. So these are some of the things that over the last 160 years, the liturgists will have to come up with, all because the original version was so objectionable. Okay, what else is there for gender equality? Equal obligation in Torah studies for men and women, for boys and girls. In other words, if in antiquity and even up to early modern times, who received the cheder education? The boy. What did the girl receive? Next to nothing. Maybe she learned how to read the Hebrew alphabet so she could read out of the Siddur or out of the Tachinus book or out of the Tehillim, but not much else. So now the reform point of view is absolute equality of Judaic education. So, but again, so again, this is the same issue as the mitzvot aseh shazman grama. In theory, it was the boys are up here, the girls are down here. So let's now raise the girls to up here equal to the boys, but then drop it all down to a very low level because we're not going to give yeshiva education. We're going to give supplemental Sunday school education, which teaches very little. So you see a pattern here. Gender equality, but of low-impact Judaism for everyone. Okay.
But even without gender equality, you have low-impact Judaism.
That's true. That's true. Now, in fact, what is the story of female Torah education in the Reform movement? So, at high levels, you don't have the ordination of women as Reform rabbis until much later. The first ordained woman rabbi was who? Regina Jonas, in the 1930s, who got private ordination after studying at the Hochschule für die Wissenschaft des Judentums at the Reform Hochschule in Berlin. But even that wasn't official ordination from the institution, it was private from some of the professors. And she was an Orthodox Jewess, or at least was a very traditional woman, and only went there because it was her only opportunity to study advanced Torah subjects. When was the first real Reform female rabbi?
Sally
Prezid in 1972. And among the conservatives, not until 1985, with Amy Eilberg. So it takes a long time, even for the heterodox, to really act upon this gender equality in Torah studies. Okay. Another point is gender equality with participation in the minyan. So you need 10 people for a quorum. Doesn't matter what the gender is. As long as you have 10, men or women, it's all good. What's the problem with that? Again, we're elevating the women to the same status as the men, but then rendering the whole topic a moot point. Because when do you need a minyan? For what purpose do you need a minyan? For davar shebikedusha, for matters that require a holy moment, matters of sacred liturgy, like Baruch Hu, Kaddish, Kedusha, and those types of things. Well, if you're synagogue service is a rigorously halachic service, then you're going to daven everything, if you have a minyan, and skip those portions that require a minyan, because Devar Shebikedusha, in the absence of a minyan. But if you're having a communal house of worship, the service is going to be the same, no matter how many people are there. I learned this firsthand. I was told when I was an assistant rabbi in Manhattan that at Emmanuel, which was only a few blocks away from where I was, they have services every day, 5:15, and it doesn't matter whether there are two people in the room or 1,000 people in the room, the cantor or the layperson who conducts the service does the same exact thing every day without fail, and they're active, the congregants are passive, it doesn't matter how many people are in the room. And I wondered, is that really true? Do you need a minyan, not a minyan? So I went one time, and I was one of four people in the room, and the person is up there conducting the service, and it doesn't matter that there are only four people in the room. So you don't have to worry about Davar Shebikedusha, because it's irrelevant to them. So yes, women are counted in the minyan, but the minyan doesn't matter anymore. Okay, that was the issue of gender equality. Okay, so Aliyahs are, in the previous conference in 1845, they discussed the getting rid of the Aufruf and calling people up for the Torah. No more Aliyot, There will be a Torah reading, but it will be done by the professional, by the Shliach Tzibur, and no one is saying the blessings over the Torah or being called by name. That was never... Well, it was implemented in some places, but not most. Most, even liberal congregations, maintained aliyot, but only for men. So, like many of these nominal changes in favor of gender equality, they were not practiced in Europe, significantly because you still had separate seating. If the women are in the gallery, how are they supposed to come down to the main floor and go up to the bima to get an aliyah? It isn't going to happen. It's only in the American environment where you have mixed pews that it's not such a difficult thing for a woman to get up just as easily as a man to get up and go to the Torah and make the blessings. Okay. Oh, the collective aliyot, yeah. It's good for the revenue. It's good for revenue. Yeah. Okay.
So when did the mixed seating start?
In Europe, in some places they never had it because the church also didn't have it. Okay. Now, another point where they discussed changes, and here they really butchered everything, was Hilchos Avelus, mourning. What are the important mourning rituals that we have?
Shiva.
What do you do during Shiva?
Sit.
You sit. Sits. Okay. So you sit at home. What change of attire do we have? So you don't change your clothes. You have a torn garment. You don't wear red leather shoes. Okay. And you abstain from work. So what do they not like? First of all, Kriya, no good in their eyes. Why?
You're in a good suit.
So aside from the fact that it's you lose money and you ruin a good suit, no, it's more than that. The very notion of a destructive act in a time of mourning reminds people of a more barbaric period, that we as enlightened, forward-thinking people who live in a different age, we know how to handle death with decorum and don't have to resort to violent and destructive acts of tearing. Now, as a congregational rabbi, and I officiated a lot of funerals, including funerals for people who have very little relationship with Judaism, I try to explain to them that it's a natural human tendency to be violent and destructive when you're really upset about something, including the loss of a loved one. So the beauty of the Judaic ritual is that you channel that destructive act into something just symbolic, like on a piece of clothing, or if you really want to water it down, a ribbon. So you don't, smash the mirrors in your home. You tear one article of clothing and genug, and that's enough. But for the reformers, that was too much. We cannot have anything that is violent in nature. Okay. Second thing, being away from society for a whole week of Shiva is too much. And being away from work, business, for a whole week is too much. Too much to compromise. So therefore, how many days of Shiva should there be? 3 days. The 3-day Shiva, the infamous 3-day Shiva. And of those 3 days, how many are really intense? Only one. The day of the funeral, your shop should be closed. Even Gentiles should not operate your shop or others on that day. It should be closed. But as for days 2 and 3, you can check the stock ticker on your iPhone, and you can have somebody else do the shop. It could be open, you just shouldn't go. And then after day 3, all's fair game. Now, this 3-day Shiva, from what I can tell, reading the memoir literature and other source material, it did not take off in Central Europe. Shiva was still observed in the latter half of the 19th century among those who were interested in observing Judaic mourning rituals. There was no 3-day Shiva. In America, however, Bismanenu, in our own time, it has become increasingly popular. Now, lav dafka, not necessarily 3 days for any specific reason, just a whole lot less than 7 because 7 is too many. And the people can't handle it, they can't get away from life for that long. So one of the responsibilities of the traditional rabbis is to counteract the destructive behaviors of the reform rabbis in allowing these 3-day observances. Okay. Another thing is, no taking off of the shoes. Basically, you have to look like a mensch. You can't look like a manuval or someone who is repulsive. You have to dress appropriately, cleaned up the whole time. So the ban on showering and the ban on shaving, forget about it. You have to look clean, presentable. What are they really worried about? So they're worried about not so much the Ostjuden, the dirty Eastern Jew with his kaftan and sidelocks and beard. They know that Jew doesn't look good. No, they're worried about the Western-looking Jew who all year long is presentable in front of the Gentile public. But for the week of Shiva or the Shloshim, following the death of a loved one, all of a sudden they look like a person from the gutter. And that was scary. It was not something that they wanted the heathen world to see.
The Jew.
But if you maintain the beard after the Shiva when you're going back to work, for the Shloshim, you're interacting with a Gentile world that doesn't look so nice. So they were very much opposed.
Beards weren't styled in those days.
if it was trimmed properly, if it looked nice, yeah. Right, but it's groomed as opposed to the scruff, which exists during a period of mourning. Okay, so these were some of the decrees they made against the Hilchos Avelos. One last area where they didn't make a decision, but they suggested something, they didn't act on it, is in the marriage laws. The marriage laws are a very sensitive topic. Along with the personal status of who is a Jew, the marriage laws are about as serious as you can get. You know, Hilchos Shabbos, it's a capital crime, right? So that's important. But Shabbos happens every week. And if you were Machal Shabbos last week or the week before, and you live to tell the story, and it's 19th century Europe, what did it really matter? It's between you and Ribono Shalom, between you and God. And maybe next week you'll be Shomer Shabbos. But personal status laws have an effect upon the community. You know, is this person a Jew? Is he a Mamzer? Is he a Halal? What's the halachic status of the individual? So one area where they were very much upset was Chalitza and Yibum. Today this doesn't happen much. Why? Because Baruch Hashem, life expectancy is very long, and most Jews are not drafted into bloody wars. Okay, but back then, 19th century, you have major wars between the European powers. People die in battle. And how old are they? Late teens, early 20s. What if they're married, recently married with no kid? So that means that the widow is subject to levirate marriage with the brother. Now, in Eastern Europe, there were problems with levirate marriage. The problems were, what happens if the other brother moved to America and we can't find him? Or he can't get back, and the ritual just cannot be performed? Or what happened if the other brother became a communist and doesn't want to perform the ritual because he thinks the religion is evil, the opium of the masses? So Eastern European Jewry had problems with practical problems with chalitza. But in Western Europe, it was a moral objection that the whole idea of the woman being tied in a zika relationship to her deceased husband's brother was repulsive to them. They couldn't. This was not for our time. It applied only in the agricultural society of the old world, where a woman with a dead husband needed someone to take her in lest she starve. So yes, Yibum made sense in the year 100 of the Common Era, but not in the year 1800 of the Common Era. So what shall we do about it? The suggestion was to say that upon the death of a man, the widow is perfectly free to marry whoever she wants, just as though she were a divorcee, meaning she has no binding familial tie to her dead husband's supply of brothers. That would have been a pretty big change in the personal status law, and they didn't act on it. Now, they did a lot of changes here. They were not afraid to make changes, but on this they were a little bit reluctant. And so they suggested it, but didn't do anything about it. Okay.
But so you had divorce, aguna, that would be the same problem.
Okay,
or
so
if you had somebody who didn't want a divorce.
So aguna issues are a separate matter, where in the eyes of most of the Reform clergy, they would prefer all matters of matrimony and divorce be taken away from the religious, the ecclesiastical hierarchy, and given over exclusively to the state. That the temporal authorities determine all these things, and if you're civilly divorced, you're divorced. And in the eyes of God and Judaism, you don't need to do anything of a religious nature. You're just divorced. That's what they would agree on. And in 1869 at Augsburg, which we'll get to in a couple of weeks, they make that determination. But in the 1840s, they're still a little bit reluctant to do that. Okay, to just abolish the notion of get or chalitza. All right. Now, in the last minute we have, the criticisms of this conference you might have thought would come from the traditionalists. After all, a lot of crazy things were said and passed at this conference. But actually, as it turns out, no. The real vociferous criticism was from the left, from the far left, who felt that at Frankfurt and Brunswick, the rabbis were really open-minded and progressive and willing to make bold changes. Whereas at Breslau, there was a spirit of conservatism, hesitance, and a dark cloud that was hanging over the conference. And they weren't up to the challenge of reforming Judaism sufficiently. That's what the extremists said. Why? Because they didn't change Shabbos to Sunday. It was spoken about, but they didn't do it. And they spoke about getting rid of Chalitza, but they didn't do it. What did they actually do? Oh, they said you don't have to sit Shiva for a whole week, and women can count the dominion. One day Yontif, if you want. But they didn't insist upon it. If they were really far to the left, they would have said there can be no second day Yontif. But they didn't do that. So there was a lot of tolerance for multiple views and for a divergence of practice that emanated from Breslau that the extremist felt was not going far enough. So we'll stop here. Next time we'll discuss what happened in the decades to follow among the real radicals. And then after that, we'll move beyond Germany. What happened in other countries? Was there moderate reform in other places? And then we'll finally move to the Orthodox. Okay.
But this is